Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Sustainable Finance Podcast. My name is Paul Ellis, and I'm your host for these programs about developments in this fast-growing industry. On today's program, we're going to be talking about how universities are key innovators in solving the climate crisis. And at the same time, as we read in the news, they're dealing with tremendous uncertainty regarding federal government funding. So, how is the director of the Columbia University Center on Sustainable Investment and the recently launched Columbia Climate School Masters in Climate Finance coping with these uncertainties in U.S. climate policy and sustainable finance? What about the volatility in career opportunities that graduates of these programs will face during the next 4 years? My guest for this episode on the Sustainable Finance Podcast is Lisa Sachs, and these are just two of the stress points she is managing in today's university environment. Lisa is also an associate professor of professional practice at the Columbia Climate School, where climate science and climate change are engaged in the 21st century's existential challenge for supremacy. Hello, Lisa, and welcome to the Sustainable Finance Podcast.
Thank you so much, Paul. It's really a pleasure to be with you.
Yes, we're very excited about this program today, and we're going to jump right into our questions, starting out with, in the past several months, many of the climate alliances around the world have dismantled. The U.S. has pulled out of the Paris Agreement and the Network for Greening the Financial System. And anti-ESG rhetoric has escalated. What impact has there been for the Columbia Center on Sustainable Investment, and what do you make of these issues in the world of climate finance?
Yeah, good big question. It's been a busy few months, huh, in the field of climate finance. Really, from the perspective of the Columbia Center on Sustainable Investment, or CCSI as we call it, our role has always been to bring clarity and rigor to climate finance discussions and approaches. So the only impact this has had has made us even more busy. But you mentioned three very important developments that I would suggest we disaggregate because I see them each differently. One is the dismantling of the climate alliances. The second is the withdrawal of the U.S. from the Network for Greening the Financial System. And the third is the anti-ESG rhetoric. And I think, of course, they're all part of some convoluted, somewhat incoherent direction of travel with respect to climate commitments. But I really think that they're very different. So if I can maybe briefly say how I see each of them. With the climate alliances, which, you know, the main ones are those under the Glasgow Financial Alliance for Net Zero, which are the net zero alliances for banks, for asset managers, for asset owners, for insurance sector, and so on. I have found that those alliances were never terribly coherent from the start. They were not very clear in what they were purporting to do. Were they purporting to be integrating risk considerations and risk management in their operations, or were they purporting to actually have an impact on the climate agenda? If you read their commitments, both of the individual institutions and of these alliances, they conflated those concepts of risk integration and impact, which are really substantially different. And then, not surprising, when what they're purporting to do is conflated, the strategies and the targets and the metrics were all misaligned relative to whatever those purported goals were. So I think that they really confused what the financial institutions were saying they were going to do, what they were actually doing, and what they're capable of doing. Because the financial sector on its own is not capable of transforming an economy. It is part of a very comprehensive, complex economic system that's subject to regulations, technological developments, consumer demand, and so on. So I was not a huge fan of these alliances from the beginning because I thought that they confused the conversation around climate finance. So to my mind, stepping back from these alliances and saying honestly that they were not fit for purpose for the financial sector that the financial sector couldn't necessarily accomplish or wasn't even intending to accomplish what they were saying they were going to do, I think is okay. What matters is what comes next, whether the financial institutions can continue the honest conversation around what it would what their challenges are in financing the energy transition, what they're really capable of doing, what they're motivated to do, the role of policy, and so on. So that's how I see the falling apart of the climate alliances. The Network for Greening the Financial System is different, actually, because it is mainly an information sharing network among central banks and financial regulators. It is not actually a network that purports to achieve any particular outcome. It is meant to support distinct central banks and financial regulators around the world to understand how climate risks and climate impacts and climate imperatives affect their individual mandates. And central banks and financial regulators around the world have different mandates. In some countries, they have more of a policy mandate. In the US, they don't. The Fed's mandate is really focused on price stability and full employment, but they're all different. But even with respect to the Fed's mandate on price stability and full employment, 100%, you can quote me here, the climate will have important impacts on the Fed's oversight of price stability and full employment, or it should. It will have impacts on price stability and full employment. So for the Fed to fulfill its own statutory mandate, it will have to understand the impacts of climate on the economy. And so to pull out of an information network, an information sharing network, is just silly, in my view. They will have to deal with these risks. And to the extent that they don't, or they don't have the cutting edge information, it is to the detriment of the US and the US economy. The last one is this anti-ESG wave of bills and subpoenas and all sorts of attacks on institutions that have ESG. And then what has been kind of an anti-ESG pushback, which I have also found largely incoherent, because ESG investing, first of all, it can take many different forms. But in practice, what it mainly refers to is assembling portfolios based on some ESG ratings that, to the extent that they measure anything, and we can talk about that, really measure how companies are managing material risks relative to their peers. And if you look at ESG portfolios compared to non-ESG portfolios, they are substantially similar, because the ESG ETFs in particular, for instance, are often market cap weighted and they're built for major indices. So their sector allocations are very closely aligned with traditional broad-based market indices, and their correlation between the holdings in the ESG ETFs and in non-ESG ETFs are substantially similar. So first of all, the completely political fossil fuel funded attacks on ESG is ridiculous. The suggestion that ESG is some woke scheme to decarbonize the economy or to achieve any other social goals is absurd. Because to the extent that the ESG investors are trying to do anything, it is to maximize returns. They still remain very heavily, by and large, as a general matter, all of these ESG, the investors that have ESG funds remain heavily invested in fossil fuels and in all of the companies across the economy that are externalizing their costs and so on. And by the way, even if they wanted to achieve any social outcome, these investors don't even really have the tools to do that. So the whole attack is totally politically motivated. But the backlash that is elicited is equally funny to my mind. The Democratic attorney generals and other advocates, their defense of ESG has been that to prohibit ESG, that ESG investing, which is incorporating environmental and social governance factors, is quote unquote just good investing. And that to prohibit ESG investing, as they have said, is like putting blindfolds on an investor. That I also don't understand, because while it is definitely true that to some extent incorporating real risks, environmental, social risks, is good investing, then I don't understand what the distinction is between ESG investing and traditional investing, because traditional investing should be integrating these risks. And then on the third hand, I would just say we have some sustainability advocates that are really clamoring to protect ESG funds as if they were actually an effective tool for achieving some sustainability outcomes. They want to protect them because they think that they really are helping to achieve some climate goals or sustainability goals, which they're not. So I have found this to be a very odd pretzel. We have a political party that claims to champion free markets that is advocating to restrict the consideration that investors can factor when they're making investment decisions. And we have a sustainability community that's putting a lot of emphasis on a strategy that has no impact on sustainability. So it's a huge distraction, in my view.
All right. So let's leave the world of climate finance for the moment. Well, not completely, because we now want to talk about the new master's degree program in climate finance that Columbia Climate School has recently launched. This is a program of you've got a lot of input into it, and tell us about this new program.
Yeah, I'm very excited about this new program. I'll be directing it. We've just launched it. We have extraordinary interest, and we'll be welcoming our first class this fall. So I'm absolutely delighted. It is a one-year master's program offered by Columbia Climate School, but in collaboration with Columbia Business School. And the core courses and the electives are split between those schools. So the students will be getting the best of the climate science and trajectories and understandings of risks and opportunities from the climate school, and then the best of the financial tools from the business school, which I think is extraordinary. It covers two dimensions of climate finance. One is that climate change has undoubtedly a major impact on financial markets, on financial institutions, and on businesses who will need new approaches to thinking about risk and opportunity. Irrespective of the politics, that is necessarily true. There are risks and there are new opportunities with the changing climate domestically and globally, and financial institutions and businesses are striving to understand those. And then, of course, we have the mounting effects of climate change on the planet. And those require new financial tools. And so this program will address both. Students will have a robust understanding of the climate science, mitigation pathways, adaptation, and how markets work, and the different financial tools, and so on. And I think that these graduates will be absolutely uniquely suited for leadership positions across the public and private sectors, as all organizations are trying to navigate this intersection in a more rigorous way.
Great. So we can look forward to those graduates coming into the world of sustainable finance and
absolutely.
And capital management across the economy in the next few years. That's great. Now, what approaches are you working on right now to increase capital flows and scaling of blended finance in the emerging markets? That's one of the big concerns that many people in the world of sustainable investing have at the moment.
Absolutely. And I will say that this has been a personal interest of mine, because the greatest climate vulnerability and the greatest climate impacts are disproportionately affecting those in emerging markets. But also, they are receiving so little of the investments and the finance in the energy transition. There's a total mismatch. At COP29, there was a commitment of the member states to, they committed some small amount, $300 billion of climate finance from all sorts of public and private sources, but with a very vague commitment that $300 billion would be used to scale $1.3 trillion of private finance into emerging markets, but with no recognition of the structural constraints of why that has been so hard in the past or how actually they would accomplish that going forward. So this has been a major focus of mine. And by the way, not only is it a real challenge, but it is a massive untapped opportunity, because these are huge growth markets for the future. Developing countries have the greatest growth potential under the right framework and with the right access to affordable finance. So the question is, what have been the challenges and how can we address those? That we do a lot of research on that at our center. I would say that there are many structural barriers that limit financial flows to developing countries. one thing that should your listeners should know is that not a single low-income country is deemed creditworthy by the main credit rating agencies. The methodologies are not actually at all looking at future prospects and so on. They're very backward look. They're decidedly backward, definitionally backward looking, but they also include metrics like GDP per capita and population. So with heavy weighting, by the way, especially the GDP per capita, which comes in multiple ways. So a small, poor country has zero chance of getting a creditworthy score from the three main credit rating agencies, S&P, Moody's, and Fitch. There are also other structural issues like that developing countries face huge currency risks. They're mainly borrowing in foreign currencies. Developed countries have currency swaps if they're an ally of the US or with the IMF, but developing countries do not. So there are many of these, and there are other factors that lead to a very high cost of capital for developing countries. So they cannot access affordable finance. That's true at the project level, because project levels are the ratings of project levels are usually limited by the sovereign rating ceiling. So it's a huge issue. The last issue I would just say is that most of the investments that are needed require long-term patient capital. We're building infrastructure systems, and they will have massive returns over a generation, especially if we invest in education and the rest of the productive economy in developing countries. But they need long-term patient capital. And most of the financing for developing countries is high cost and short-term, which leads to major liquidity constraints and then defaults, and then their ratings are downgraded and so on. So we are basically trying to look at this, to approach this in two ways, if I could simplify. One is to better understand and address these structural barriers, which need to be addressed at a institutional level. How do you support countries more generally to access or in the systems that are so biased against developing countries to allow for more patient, long-term, affordable finance? But the second is that to the extent that there remain either high perceived risks or real risks, how can we de-risk those investments using innovative financial products or tools or guarantees and so on? There's an emergent, but often discussed, there's a kind of exciting but still emergent field of blended finance, which covers many different types of public and private financing, whether it's through guarantees or some concessional base or even just co-investing and so on, that are trying to scale more private capital. But those are hard to scale.
All right. Thank you. That's a good explanation. And I completely agree with your perspective around how we should be working more carefully and clearly to support the developing economies, which is, as you suggested, where the greatest opportunities are. Now, the United States is retreating from climate commitments and financing of clean energy. From your perspective, how are students and faculty at the Columbia Climate School managing the current uncertainties related to career opportunities and their desire to make positive contributions to climate adaptation and resilience?
Yeah, well, it's definitely been a whirlwind, especially for the past 2 months, maybe even the past week, especially. But what I will say with absolute confidence is that the climate agenda is not going anywhere. At an institutional level, with the financial sector, with businesses, with real estate, with mortgages, with insurance, all of these sectors are critically grappling with both risk and opportunity of the very real climate effects. That's just domestically. So, and the uncertainty and the incoherence of policy is not helping that. It's not helping our own domestic stakeholders and our financial sector constituents who recognize that there are real implications of climate, again, both risk and opportunity. And in the face of tremendous uncertainty and incoherence, it's causing a lot of damage to the sector. But I don't think, I'm confident, I know for sure that in an institutional level within financial institutions and businesses and insurance and state policymakers and so on, there remains a real need for practitioners who really understand the integration of and the intersection of climate and finance. But arguably even more importantly, or not more importantly, but as importantly, the U.S. is just lost and ceding its leadership on these issues to other parts of the world where there has been no wavering in the commitment to financing the energy transition and to more meaningfully address climate. There may have been some concerns that the U.S. pulling out of these Paris Agreement or of NGFS would have knock-on effects. And I actually think we'll see the opposite. First of all, in the Network for Greening, the financial sector, the U.S. was something like the 90th country to join. And there are 143 countries now as the U.S. leaves. It was started by European and Chinese monetary authorities who remain the leads of the NGFS. And globally, in terms of investing in the energy transition, the U.S. pulling back has just made even more clear who the leaders are in financing the energy transition. That's primarily China, who has accounted for more clean energy investment in the past few years than the rest of the world combined, and is a global leader in building every component of energy systems, battery storage, battery supplies, EVs, the high-tech manufacturing, and so on. And their commitment has been absolutely unwavering, not only because of the climate imperative, perhaps not even mainly because of the climate imperative, but because that's the future of the economy for affordable, clean, independent, secure, diversified energy sources. And the rest of the world wants it, and China will provide it if the U.S. does not. So I really believe that the opportunities remain as robust, even if we're all reeling a bit from the day-to-day headlines and domestic uncertainty. But the energy transition is happening. It's happening on an economic basis as much as it is on a planetary survival basis. And I'm absolutely confident that our graduates will be best positioned around the world to help all organizations, public and private, navigate the future. And I really hope that the U.S. catches up and doesn't lose its way so dramatically, because this is the future, and our economy and our relevance and our competitiveness and our stability all depend on our recognizing that. So I hope that the federal government comes around soon. And in the meantime, I appreciate the continued leadership at the state and the local level, where they haven't lost their focus and in fact are helping to fill the vacuum domestically as well.
Yes, I was reading an article over the weekend about the explosion in growth of the two-wheeled EV mobility universe. It's growing most rapidly, of course, in China, as you suggested, but also very fast in the EU as well. And of course, we're in large urban areas. This is one of the ways that we're dealing with some of the climate risk issues around carbon pollution and health issues and that sort of thing. So thanks for bringing all of these subjects to our followers, Lisa. And where online can they go to learn more about Columbia University Center on Sustainable Investment? And how can they best get in touch with you with questions about the topics that we've discussed in today's episode?
Well, first, let me thank you again for your leadership in educating the public about these issues, because, frankly, it is a confused landscape out there. And the more that we all understand the issues, the direction of travel, and that we can think critically about the headlines and the narratives, the more prepared we'll be to navigate an individual level, institutional level, and societal level the years ahead. So thank you for what you're doing and for letting me be a part of this show. The two places I'd recommend to follow our work are the center I direct, the Columbia Center on Sustainable Investment. As I said, it's CCSI, so our website is just ccsi.columbia.edu. And for me personally, I've taken to LinkedIn to share my rapid responses to the quick news cycle and trying to help bring clarity to these issues and on the ones that we've talked about today and more. So I would encourage those who are interested to follow me on LinkedIn. Again, I'm Lisa Sachs and on LinkedIn. And I always welcome and learn from engaging directly with those who are interested in this space. So I'm very much look forward to connecting with your followers.
Great. Well, thank you very much, Lisa Sachs, the director of the Columbia University Center on Sustainable Investment, for joining us in today's episode. And followers of the Sustainable Finance Podcast can join me again next week for another episode. I'm Paul Ellis, and this is the Sustainable Finance Podcast.